Good morning, Mendocino. This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the December 11th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. The lead editorial in yesterday's New York Times anticipated today's program. President Obama and President Hassan Rouhani of Iran both spent time last weekend, it began, trying to sell the Iran nuclear deal to skeptics among their constituents. In Mr. Obama's case, that meant addressing pro-Israel supporters at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, a Washington think tank. Mr. Rouhani's speech to a university audience in Tehran was televised nationally. While either side could undermine the November interim agreement, and with it the best chance in 30 years for genuine thaw in Iranian-American relations, the more serious threat seems to be on the American side. That's the New York Times. In the agreement, the Times editorial said, Iran committed to freezing or rolling back parts of its nuclear program and allowing daily inspections for 6 months in exchange for modest sanctions relief. In the meantime, negotiators for both sides will work toward a more lasting agreement. While not perfect, the six-month hiatus is unquestionably a good deal and will put the first meaningful curbs on Iran's program in a decade. It certainly beats military action, which Mr. Obama holds out as an option if negotiations fail, end quote. What the editorial referred to as a serious threat originating on the American side was illustrated in an article distributed yesterday to the Jewish World Press by the Jewish Telegraphic Agency. Both the headline and subhead and the first several paragraphs stood in apparent contradiction to one another. Listen and see if I'm not correct. The top headline was positive, quote, pro-Israel groups backing away from confrontation with Obama over Iran, is how it read. But then below, in just slightly smaller type, was apparently the true story. Instead, it read, AIPAC's executive director calls for groups to focus on passing new sanctions as a means of shaping a final deal, end quote, something that Obama has been pleading with them not to do. And as you heard in NPR, John Kerry has done the same today. When it comes to dealing between Iran and major powers, the JTRA article went on, Israel and the pro-Israel community are retreating from a strategy of confrontation and working instead to influence the contours of a final agreement. In a conference call last week, Howard Kaur, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's executive director, advised pro-Israel activists and leaders not to confront the Obama administration directly over the, quote, difference of strategy between the U.S. and Israel on Iran. Instead, Kaur said to focus on passing new sanctions as a means of shaping a final deal, end quote. New sanctions? That's what Obama has expressly asked them not to do, since one aspect of the deal is that no new sanctions would be placed against Iran in the six-month negotiating period. But as the Times' leading columnist, Tom Friedman, wrote on November 20th from Abu Dhabi, never have I seen Israel and America's core Arab allies working more in concert to stymie a major foreign policy initiative of a sitting U.S. president, and never have I seen more lawmakers, Democrats and Republicans, more willing to take Israel's side against their own presidents. I'm certain, writes Friedman, this comes less from any careful consideration of the facts and more from a growing tendency by many American lawmakers to do whatever the Israeli lobby asked them to do in order to garner Jewish votes and campaign donations, end quote. Tom Friedman writing in the New York Times, November 20th. Welcome aboard, Tom. As if to confirm Friedman's comments on December 1st, The Washington Post reported, quote, the question of Iran's sanctions now finds him at odds with a hefty portion of his own party's lawmakers as well as most Republicans. A bipartisan juggernaut of senior senators is spending the remaining week of the Thanksgiving recess forging an agreement on new sanctions bill that the senators hope to pass before breaking again for Christmas, according to the article. Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman, New Jersey Democrat Robert Menendez, one of the leading proponents of new sanctions, said he wonders what all the fuss is about. From my perspective, he said, it strengthens the administration's hand and positions the United States for the possibility that a permanent agreement cannot ultimately be struck. Menendez said of the new sanctions bill, it would make clear to the Iranians if they don't strike a deal, this is what's coming. Menendez is working across the aisle with Illinois Republican Mark Kirk, who will be his likely co-sponsor. The power of the Israel lobby to not only challenge a U.S. president on a critical foreign policy issue, but to thumb its nose at American laws and institutions since well before the state even came into being is what I'll be discussing about 20 minutes past the hour with a familiar Takes on the World guest, Grant Smith of the Washington-based Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, or IRMEP. So stay tuned for that. Meanwhile, the Obama administration has other Middle East headaches. His Secretary of State, John Kerry, has been trying to keep the sagging negotiation between Israel and the Palestinian Authority satrap from totally collapsing and has become exasperated in the process. To bridge the gap between the two sides, or so we are told, Kerry has enlisted the services of Martin Indyk, the London-born, Australian-raised, Obama-appointed U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. Indyk is on leave from his position as Vice President and Director for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, which, for all intents and purposes, was purchased by Israeli-American billionaire media mogul Haim Saban in 2002 for $12.3 million. Indyk had previously worked for AIPAC and had been the founding director of what has become the most important think tank in the nation's capital, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, or WINEP, which had been set up quietly by AIPAC in 1985 to elevate its work on Israel's behalf to a new and higher level. In 1993, President Clinton wanted him to be the U.S. ambassador to Israel so badly that he had Congress pass special legislation granting him U.S. citizenship. So now we have the one-time senior AIPAC staff member and director of the AIPAC spawn WINEP authorized to draft a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, but clearly he can't do it alone. He needs help. So who does Kerry turn to but David Makovsky, a one-time guest on Takes on the World, who has been working as a senior fellow at, where else, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and as a former editor of the Jerusalem Post, for 10 years, in fact. But there's more to the story than that. The day before, mark you, the day before Makovsky's appointment to Kerry's staff, the current executive director of the Washington Institute, Robert Satloff, had published a lengthy article in the D.C. online magazine Politico entitled, "Obama's Fight with Israel, This Time It's Serious." He bemoaned U.S. and Israeli differences over both Iran and the so-called peace process and chided Kerry for having, quote, inexplicably lost his cool when Israel announced construction approval for 1,900 new apartments in disputed territory, end quote. Kerry's surprisingly ferocious reaction, complained Satloff, was to lump all construction together and denounce it, publicly question Israel's commitment to peace, rhetorically ask whether Israel prefers a third intifada, and wonder aloud whether Israel will ever get its troops out of the West Bank, troops that have worked with Palestinian security forces to fight terrorism and prevent the spread of Hamas influence. If the Obama administration, Satloff went on, wanted to raise the blood pressure of even the least paranoid Israelis, the combination of the rush to a deal in Geneva with Iran and an attack on Israel's peacemaking credentials was a sure way to do it, end quote. Why Satloff and the whole lot of them at WINEP and AIPAC are not obliged to register as foreign agents will be one of the things I'll be discussing later with Grant Smith. In Israel, there have been widespread protests against the government decision to expel up to 70,000 Bedouins from their homes and villages in Israel, a sharp reminder of Israel's ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians that began in 1948. The government proposes to relocate the Palestinian Bedouins from their present homes to government-approved townships under what is being called the Prior Plan, which Israel's parliament approved by a three-vote majority in June. The Prior Plan would destroy 35 Bedouin villages in the Negev region and extinguish Bedouin claims to land seized from them after the foundation of Israel. The government has never provided basic services to these villages, while right beside them, in many cases, are new, modern, fully serviced communities for Jewish settlers only. Supporters of the plan say that it will compensate the Bedouin for their lost lands and improve their economic status. The European Parliament is unconvinced and has condemned the plan and demanded it be ended. So has the UN Committee for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination and the UN Office for Human Rights and Human Rights Watch. The plan was not negotiated with the Bedouin. It is to be imposed on them. The protests and the claims of the Bedouins have been dismissed by Israel's Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman, whose recent acquittal of obvious fraud charges by a judge, there being no jury trials in Israel, outraged the prosecutors who went public with their criticisms. Well, we are fighting for the lands of the Jewish people, and there are those intentionally to try to rob and seize them, Lieberman, a nightclub bouncer in his native Moldova, posted to his Facebook page. Well, turning to Syria, investigative journalist Seymour Hersh has just published an article in the London Review of Books that exonerates Syria from the charges of having used sarin gas against the opposition while pointing the finger at the al-Nusra front. Barack Obama, he writes, did not tell the whole story of this autumn when he tried to make the case that Bashar al-Assad was responsible for the chemical weapons attack near Damascus on 21st of August. In some instances, he omitted important intelligence, and in others, he presented assumptions as facts. Most significant, he failed to acknowledge something known to the U.S. intelligence community, that the Syrian army is not the only party in the country's civil war that has access to sarin, the nerve agent that a U.N. study concluded, without assessing responsibility, had been used in the rocket attack. In the months before the attack, the American intelligence agency, writes Hersh, produced a series of highly classified reports culminating in a formal operations order, a planning document that precedes a ground invasion, citing evidence that the al-Nusra Front, a jihadi group affiliated with al-Qaeda, had mastered the mechanics of creating sarin and was capable of manufacturing it in quantity. When the attack occurred, al-Nusra should have been a suspect, but the administration cherry-picked intelligence to justify a strike against Assad. A former senior intelligence officer told me, wrote Hersh, that the Obama administration had altered the available information in terms of its timing and sequence to enable the president and his advisors to make intelligence retrieved days after the attack look as if it had been picked up and analyzed in real time as the attack was happening. The distortion, he said, reminded him of the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident when the Johnson administration reversed the sequence of National Security Agency intercepts to justify one of the early bombings of North Vietnam. The same official said there was immense frustration inside the military and intelligence bureaucracy, wrote Hersh. The guys are throwing their hands in the air and saying, how can we help this guy Obama when he and his cronies in the White House make up the intelligence as they go along? Well, that's Seymour Hersh in the current issue of the London Review of Books, which can be read online. Turning to Afghanistan, where despite Obama's promise to withdraw U.S. troops by the end of the year, next year, he and the Pentagon clearly want to maintain a limited U.S. military presence, supposedly to train Afghan troops and conduct special operations against the remnants of al-Qaeda, although there are likely other reasons which Washington is unwilling to disclose. Standing in the way has been the mercurial Hamid Karzai, former U.N. oil executive installed by Washington as president following the U.S. invasion, who has demanded U.S. soldiers no longer be allowed to make night raids on Afghani homes. At the same time, he has ceded to the U.S. military the responsibility for disciplining U.S. soldiers who commit crimes against Afghan civilians, a surrender of sovereignty that the U.S. was unable to obtain from Iraq. This led to the U.S. withdrawal from that country, leaving in its wake hundreds of thousands of dead civilians and countless others, including deformed babies, sickened by the military's use of so-called depleted uranium, a decimated infrastructure, and an unending religious war which this year alone has taken close to 6,000 lives. On the same trip, Hagel warned Pakistan that it risks losing some of U.S. financial aid if a key supply route to Afghanistan remains blocked by protesters. Hundreds of Pakistanis have clogged roads in Peshawar and other northwestern towns to protest U.S. drone strikes, leading the Pentagon to announce a week ago that it was halting shipments on one of the main routes into Afghanistan. Hagel reportedly told Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif during a meeting in Islamabad that reimbursements to Pakistan for Afghan war costs may be jeopardized in Congress by the holdup of supplies. Pakistan has received more than $10 billion in U.S.-led coalition support funds, making it the program's biggest recipient. Sharif reportedly told Hagel that drone strikes were, quote, counterproductive to our efforts to combat terrorism and extremism on an enduring basis, end quote. Former cricketer Imran Khan's Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf party which governs the northwestern area where NATO's goods passed through, saw Hagel's visit as evidence that the blockade that began November 23rd has successfully pressured the United States, according to the party's information secretary, Shireen Mazari. She said that it plans to continue halting supplies until the U.S. stops drone strikes or Sharif takes a firmer stance. A CIA drone strike on November 1st killed the leader of the Pakistani Taliban in what the government in Islamabad claimed was an attempt to derail peace talks with the group. At the time, Pakistan's foreign ministry summoned U.S. Ambassador Richard Olson to protest the attack after the death of Hakimullah Massoud, head of the Tehrik-i-Taliban. Hagel's visit to Pakistan came a day after Karzai and Iran's President Hassan Rouhani agreed in Tehran to a cooperation accord on peace and security issues, Karzai's office said in a statement, which will not make Washington or very happy. Finally, the passing of Nelson Mandela revealed, as I expected, the sheer hypocrisy of those world officials and organizational spokespersons who reviled Mandela and the African National Congress as terrorists, and who these past few days, with fork and tongue, pretend that they were brothers in arms with the dead South African leader in his long struggle for justice. In fact, it was not until 2008, 17 years after Mandela was released from prison and became a free man, that the White House took him off its terrorist list. That should come as no surprise, as there is strong evidence indicating that the CIA tipped off South African intelligence as to his whereabouts when he was arrested in 1962, and that Mandela